The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
But welcome to the show. We'll be joining John Duggan at around 11:15 at Cheltenham in the Cotswolds. Day one, lovely sunshine. That snow this morning. The four bankers, two of them won and won well, Kopeck, De Boards and Lossiemouth. I've never seen a race like the Champion Hurdle. Two previous winners the last 2 years both fell, and Stateman had it on his mercy, and a bit like Annie Power, overreached on the last and crumpled on landing when winning. So we're going to get today's tips. I think Willie Mullins will have three winners today, and I'm greatly looking forward to all of that. My heart went out to Reds fans, Liverpool's fans last night, knocked out of the quarterfinals. They got a miracle result in Paris to come away when they should have been beaten 4-1 to lead the tie at 1-0. They conceded a goal, went to extra time, went to penalties, and they got knocked out. I've been to the Kop end on some of those European nights, and it is a really, really incredible atmosphere and experience, and very hostile. So it does show, when you look at the English clubs, that the Premier League is not necessarily the best league. The Champions League is certainly throwing up fantastic teams. Barcelona, Bayern Munich and all. Lots to look forward to there. But the Reds are out. Now, big news. I kind of feel a little bit of I told you so on my podcast. I was saying that people had misinterpreted the row in the Oval Office, because I said the way this is going to end up, that they just want to get Ukraine into line. That's the first phase, and they had a row to engineer that. The real row is going to be to get Russia to agree to a ceasefire. So what happened in the last 24 hours in Jeddah after 8 hours of talks was really smart, I think, by Zelensky. They've agreed, not only they proposed an air and naval 30-day ceasefire, but it's to everything. And now it is over to Russia. And what do you know? Foreign Minister Lavrov is starting to say, well, no, I don't know if we'll agree to this, and so on, calling the Russians bluff. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome to the show Professor of Politics at the School of Law and Government, DCU, Donika Obikon. Donika, welcome to the show. First of all, talk us through what happened in the last 24 hours.
Well, good morning, Ivan. Well, these talks had, you know, been well heralded. The Ukrainians had gone into them already talking up the prospects of a ceasefire for 30 days that would include air and sea. So the Americans obviously pushed them one step further so that it would be a complete ceasefire, land, air and sea. And, you know, as you say, it's smart in terms of the options that are available to the Ukrainians. This was as much about healing the rift between Ukraine and the United States as it was about resolving the much deeper rift between Ukraine and Russia. So they get something in return for this commitment. They get a restoration of aid. That's not new aid. That's aid that was promised under the Biden administration. And they get that vital intelligence sharing back again, which helps them protect themselves from missiles that are incoming. There were missiles overnight flying into Ukraine. That was, you might say, Russia's first response to these proposals. But at least the Ukrainians are able to say that the ball is in Russia's court, and that's been amplified by the Americans. And for the first time in several weeks, the pressure is taken off for now Ukraine, and at least in terms of the diplomatic efforts, is put on Russia.
So one of the sticking points for America was, if there was peace, what would be the extent of the American backstop? So you have the French and the Brits offering to put peacekeeping troops in, and maybe others in Europe, and the US were reluctant on that. Are we now looking at a shift in that position, that America may be involved in, if there is a peace deal, enforcing the peace?
There's no public evidence to support that, unfortunately. That's certainly what the Ukrainians have been looking for, and that was at the root of that debacle of a meeting at the Oval Office where the Ukrainians were openly, raising this issue of a security guarantee when, from the American perspective, they were to sign an agreement on minerals. And that's, of course, still on the table. Still, the Americans are looking for that to be signed. So this is at the heart of the problem, because we have been here before. We've had ceasefires, we've had agreements, we've had peace processes, and all of them in the past, going back to the most fundamental one, perhaps in 1994, have not been respected by Russia. And I mention 1994 in particular because this war in general has been a very bad example for those who are pushing for nuclear non-proliferation, because Ukraine inherited a huge nuclear stockpile in the early 90s, which they were coaxed into giving up by the Americans, by the British, and by the Russians in return for security guarantees, which, let's face it, were never honored. So the Ukrainians come to this with a wealth of experience in broken promises and broken treaties. And that's why they've tried to put this at the heart of any kind of peace process. But the Americans, this whole American first is also American alone. They want the Europeans to take the lead in any kind of post-conflict security arrangements. The problem there is that, and you know, the foreign minister of Russia has reiterated it only in the last few hours, they won't accept European peacekeepers. They see them as NATO in other clothes. And, you know, Trump has said at the Oval Office that he got a commitment from the Russians that they would accept them, and then they deny that. So Trump has a habit of kind of speaking on other people's behalfs without necessarily doing the homework. And I think that this is from an American perspective, from a Ukrainian perspective, this is a good news story. But the harsh realities behind why Russia invaded Ukraine remain undiminished. And the Russians have clearly said that they want to keep the territory they have. They want new territory, which they don't have. They want, of course, a demilitarized and, from their perspective, denazified Ukraine. And they want Ukraine to have no effective security guarantees. And that's their position. Trump hasn't managed to extract one concession thus far from the Russians, but he has offered, without the Ukrainians' permission, many concessions in advance to the Russians, for example, on things like territory and NATO membership.
Let's talk territory. So you had 2014, you had Crimea, and that ended up permanently in Russia's hands. So then you had the 2022 invasion, you had eastern Ukraine, Donbass, and so on. Now, there is reference in the settlement that land territory will be discussed. What are the options there in terms of if there was a peace deal?
Well, the options, I mean, the best case option might be, if you're trying to get something from the Russians, might be to freeze the conflict. But that would leave almost 20% of Ukraine in Russia's hands. The Russians are looking for more than that. They have enacted their own constitution, of course, and the 2022 version includes all of Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson, as well as Crimea, of course, as parts of Russia. So from the Russian narrative, and they repeat this every night on Russian television, Ukraine is occupying Russian territory when they're in Kherson and when they're in Zaporizhia and when they're in Donetsk. And that mindset doesn't seem likely to change. So in terms of territory, these positions are diametrically opposed. Ukraine says it cannot accept a Russian occupation over 1 centimeter of Ukraine. There was a nuanced interview that Zelensky gave to Sky News back in November, where he more or less said that they could contemplate, as part of an overall package, a temporary acquiescence to Russian presence, but it would not be accepted in principle. And the idea would be that they would hope in the longer term that through diplomatic efforts and cooling down the process, they could get those territories back. I think an example might be the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. They were for decades under Kremlin control. The West never accepted the legitimacy of that. And of course, you know, the peoples themselves didn't. And they hoped that the day would come, which did come in 1991, 1992, when they got their independence back. So I think they would try and cut their losses and play the long game. That's a possibility. But there's no evidence, as I said, that Russia is interested in that. From their perspective, who's going to force them? I mean, the Americans are withdrawing support from the US, the EU. They feel, I mean, there was open derision of EU armies on Russian television recently. One state TV anchor saying that you could fit the entire British army into Wembley and still have a lot of space left over. So they're not afraid of the Europeans. They know the Americans are disengaging. And they fought the Ukrainians for 3 years. They haven't, of course, advanced as far as they'd like, but they feel the momentum is somewhat with them at the moment. So they're not in the the mood music isn't really there.
Well, I don't know now, Donica, if that's entirely true. I mean, after 3 years, the sanctions are starting to bite in Russia. They have essentially a war economy. Their trade is disastrous. They have 21% inflation. But my question to you is, Steve Witkoff, Trump's envoy, when he goes to the Kremlin, what do you think is going to be the response?
I think the Russians will play for time in this way. They will say, you know, thank you very much for getting the Ukrainians to agree to a ceasefire. But if you want us to sign up to something, there will be a lot of conditions attached, because they're on the record, Putin and Lavrov, over and over again, of saying they have no intention of signing up to an unconditional ceasefire. From their perspective, they invaded Ukraine for concrete reasons. And until those underlying reasons are removed, they don't see any progress. So I think it would be hard. I completely agree with what you're saying. There is potential to exert leverage on Russia. I think the big tragedy of Trump's approach to this is that when he came to power, he had so much leverage potentially over Russia, which he didn't have during his first term. You have to remember that the American economy is 14 times greater than Russia's. And, you know, they are hurting because of sanctions. They couldn't even, of course, repel the Ukrainians from Kursk yet. They've been there for several months. They weren't able to save their ally, Bashar al-Assad, in Syria. So they are weak. But the Americans have clearly signaled that they see this as part of a much larger geopolitical deal. And Russia is, for them, the prize. Ukraine is kind of almost an inconvenience, getting in the way of a larger Russian deal. So when Marco Rubio met the Russian team in Saudi Arabia a couple of weeks ago, he was clear to emphasize that he saw the potential for a great economic partnership between Russia and the United States evolving from this. And I think that's kind of the key, really. And the minerals deal is also there, as I said. Unfortunately, from a Ukrainian perspective, I mean, Putin wants Ukrainian land. The Americans right now want Ukrainian resources.
Yeah, and surely it's part of American strategy to, like, one of the disasters for America in this whole conflict as has been that it's driven China, who are America's real enemy of the future, has driven Russia and China closer together, which is a real disaster for America.
Yeah, and I do detect, if you can detect, a strategy behind what the Trump administration are trying to do, is to try and put a wedge between Russia and China, because for them, of course, and this is not unique to them, you can go back to Obama and the pivot to Asia, for them, China is the big enemy. So if they can somehow resolve their differences with Russia and they can weaken that adversarial partnership, in a way, it's an inversion of what Richard Nixon tried in the 1970s, when you remember he went to China and recognized the People's Republic of China. And that was a way to undermine the Soviet Union People's Republic of China partnership, which then the Soviet Union was the big enemy. The Kremlin was the big enemy. Now things are completely inverted. China's economy is 10 times bigger than Russia's. So they're trying, I think, to see a situation where they could potentially reach out to Russia. And that might, as I said, move them away from their alliance with China.
Professor Donica O'Beacon, Professor of Politics, School of Law and Government at DCU. Thank you for joining us on The Pat Kenny Show. Now,
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.